Nathan Rabin is the head writer for the Onion's entertainment section, AV Club. He's also the author of The Big Rewind, a memoir brought to you by Popular Culture. In the book, Rabin chronicles the pivotal role that pop culture has played throughout his life. To the best of our knowledge, producer Doug Gordon prepared this feature on Nathan Rabin and The Big Rewind.
I think I would be completely insane if it weren't for pop culture. I think I would lose my struggle with depression. It never ends, and I will always be depressive. I'll probably always be in therapy. I'll probably always be on medication. But it's something that you can fight, and I feel like pop culture has given me these tools to, if not win the war, then at least win more battles than I lose.
Nathan Rabin has had more than his share of battles during his life. As Roger Ebert says about Rabin's memoir, The Big Rewind, Nathan Rabin's life reads like a fanboy's collision with Dostoevsky. In the book, Rabin uses a specific pop culture product as a springboard to explore the different periods in his life. For example, Susanna Kazin's memoir, Girl Interrupted, is Rabin's touchstone for his own time in a mental hospital when he was 14.
I just fell deeper and deeper into like this coma of hopelessness. And there were times when I'd actually, you know, kind of fantasize about like what a mental hospital would be like. And, you know, on movies and television, there are basically two different kinds of mental hospitals, one of which is like the snake pit, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, a nightmare mental hospital where it's like the worst place in the world and nobody would ever want to be. And then the other is the sort of idyllic rural place of like relaxation and enchantment. And I'm not sure those actually exist. And one of the interesting things about Girl Interrupted is the hospital that Susanna Kazin was at was considered one of the best in the country. And it was just an incredibly empty experience for her. And it was just kind of this purgatory where you're not really growing or developing. You're just kind of like frozen in time and you're just kind of existing. So I was very, very, very unhappy. And I would fantasize about my fantasy mental hospital, which I have to be pretty screwed up for that, like, to be occupying your 14-year-old thoughts. When I wasn't thinking about girls, I was thinking about my movies. I was thinking about my fantasy mental hospital.
Medication time. Medication time.
I remember being led to my room, and there was a boy from Peoria who was my roommate. And again, a very sweet kid, very good-natured. He really did not belong in a mental hospital. Like, he was just kind of going through stupid teenage stuff. That's what a lot of the people there were. And I remember saying to him, like, man, they put me here because they think I want to kill myself. And I didn't before, but now I really do. So he kind of politely excused himself and told the person on staff that I had just threatened to commit suicide. So I was ordered to take my mattress into the hallway and was told that I was on suicide watch for the night. And it's ironic, whether I say in the book that I'm sort of a collector of bitter ironies. Some people collect stamps, some people collect baseball cards, I collect bitter ironies. So I was lying there like sobbing to myself, and the woman on staff was just kind of glaring at me and saying, you know, crying won't get you anywhere. And then a little later, I remember her telling one of the other people, like, I just don't understand why anybody thinks The Simpsons is funny. I mean, what's so funny about a father strangling his son every week? Like, what's amusing about child abuse? And I just, again, thought it was just so deeply, deeply, like, bitterly ironic that here she was expressing no empathy or compassion whatsoever for this, you know, 14-year-old boy sobbing his lungs out 5 feet away from her and, you know, expressing all this empathy for an imaginary cartoon boy. And it's ironic, too, that I ended up interviewing Matt Groening about 15 years later. I think actually isn't ironic. I'm abusing the word ironic in Alanis Morissette-like fashion. Ray Yayain on my wedding day, yes, and a black fly in my Chardonnay. And yeah, so I thought, you know, when I interviewed Matt Groening 15 years later, of kind of mentioning to him, like, hey, how much kind of The Simpsons meant to me at that moment, and how if the mental hospital hated The Simpsons, then that gave me one more reason to love them.
Here's Rabin reading an excerpt from The Big Rewind.
At Arkham Asylum, I had a chance to finally escape the prison of self, to satiate my curiosity about the world by engaging with the suffering souls around me. But I was too paralyzed with rage to connect with my fellow patients. When you're depressed, it's like there's an invisible wall separating you from the rest of the world. You long to make meaningful connections, yet there's an impenetrable barrier between you and the rest of humanity that makes that impossible. That's why there is something safe and comforting about the passivity of moviegoing. Movies and television give and give and give without asking anything in return. There was no danger that at the end of Pee-wee's Big Adventure, Pee-wee would step down from the screen, empathetically place a hand on my shoulder, and earnestly inquire, "Why do you have so much anger towards your father, Nathan? He's trying his best. He really is." Movies afforded the rewards of human interaction with none of the terrifying hazards of actual human contact. Looking back, I wish I'd made more of an effort to connect with my fellow patients, to try and understand the poignant cutter girls with telltale purple scars on their wrists and the testosterone-poisoned roughneck boys. I was deaf to the poetry of their sad lives. I suffered from a fatal lack of curiosity about anything that wasn't on a big or little screen. I never bought into the idea of Arkham Asylum was anything but a cynical money-making enterprise, but as the weeks dragged on interminably, my will to fight was replaced by a pragmatic desire to get out by any means necessary. I grew obsessed with the prospect that I'd spend Christmas and New Year's under the hospital's fluorescent lights. At night, sometimes I'd hear the muffled screams of the patients who lived on the floor above us, no-hopers who'd be leaving the hospital only in a body bag. Every anguished howl was a blood-curdling warning from the ghosts of Christmas future. I finally accepted what is perhaps the quintessential compromise of adulthood, the need to sacrifice your will and desires in order to get what you want. Came to understand the practical necessity of what Ilya Kazan calls the Anatolian smile, the pragmatic grin that masks underlying bitterness and resentment. I realized that all I had to do to get out was say the words everyone wanted to hear, that I was sorry for all the hurt I'd caused my father, which was true, that I realized how out of control I'd been, but vowed to be much better in the future.
Rabin's pop culture touchstone for the chapter, A Woefully Premature Happy Ending, is the 2002 film 8 Mile, starring rapper Eminem.
8 Mile is really fascinating in that it is an incredibly restrained movie. In a lot of ways, it's very, very dark and very challenging. And so much of hip-hop is about sort of bluster and bravado and, you know, being the world's most powerful, virile man. So it was very kind of brave and noble of Eminem to depict himself in 8 Mile as somebody who is terrified of the world, of somebody who is so anxious that he throws up before he has a battle, of somebody who hates himself so much that he just can't express himself at all. And he's so deeply ashamed of everything about him and his life, you know, his mother being crazy and kind of out of control, about his girlfriend being kind of promiscuous and not very faithful to him. And what happens over the course of the movie is he finally realizes, like, all these things that I hate about myself are things that I can use. And instead of running away from it, instead of being ashamed, I can make fun of it, and I can be self-deprecating, and I can own these things, and I can have power over them instead of letting them have power over me. And I felt like that's kind of what happened with me, where growing up, I was so filled with self-hatred, and I thought of people, you know, that I spent time in a mental hospital, that I grew up in a group home, that I lived with a foster family, and they rejected me, that I never knew my mother, that my dad, who I love deeply, is sick and, you know, hasn't been able to hold a job for 15 years. And I got to a certain point where I'm like, you know what? Like, I don't need to be ashamed of those things. Like, I've gotten through that. Like, it's made me a stronger person, and it's made me the man that I am today. And also popular culture, I think. I remember growing up, in my book, I said that growing up, television was so much more than just a way to spend 12 to 16 hours out of every day. But my dad would see me watching television and be like, oh, he's curing brain cancer there, huh, son? And little did they know that actually watching television and immersing myself in pop culture would actually be the thing that would get me out of where I was, that it would be kind of my ticket to this world that I desperately wanted to live in.
Yo. His palms are sweaty, knees weak, arms are heavy, there's vomit on his sweater already, mom's spaghetti, he's nervous, but on the surface he looks calm and ready to drop bombs, but he keeps on forgetting what he wrote down, the whole crowd goes so loud, he opens his mouth, but the words won't come out, he's choking how, everybody's choking now, the clock's run out, time's up, over, blast.
Rabin was a regular on the short-lived American movie classics cable TV show, Movie Club with John Ridley. It was there that Rabin made a professional enemy who unleashed his inner Frank Grimes. Who is Frank Grimes? He's a character in Homer's Enemy, one of the darkest episodes ever of The Simpsons. Frank Grimes, or Grimey, as he does not like to be called, is the man who had to struggle for everything he got. When Grimey meets Homer Simpson, he can't believe how easy everything is for Homer.
God, I've had to work hard every day of my life, and what do I have to show for it? This briefcase and this haircut. And what do you have to show for your lifetime of sloth and ignorance?
What?
Everything. A dream house, 2 cars, a beautiful wife, a son who owns a factory, fancy clothes, and lobsters for dinner. And do you deserve any of it? No.
What are you saying?
I'm saying you're what's wrong with America, Simpson. You coast through life, you do as little as possible, and you leech off decent, hard-working people, like me. If you lived in any other country in the world, you'd have starved to death long ago.
He's got you there, Dad.
So within the context of Movie Club, there was a woman named Zoriana Kitt, who was an entertainment reporter for, I guess, KTLA. And yeah, it kind of seemed to me like she lived a pretty charmed life. And again, I feel bad saying that, you know, because I don't know people's entire stories, and it's possible that she really suffered, that she went through a lot of difficult things. And I kind of allude to that, but maybe I don't allude to it enough. And that kind of within this context, I very much felt like Frank Grimes, where I just had to suffer and suffer and suffer for everything that ever happened to me. If you watch Iron Man, that's Zoran Kitt playing Zoran Kitt, where, yeah, she just kind of seemed to stumble into all the success. And again, it's very possible that she works really, really hard, but, you know, that's not the way that I saw it. And that I, on the other hand, had to work really, really hard to get to where I am, and kind of pays off in that I auditioned to be a guest critic on Ebert and Roper. And this is something I wanted really, really badly. I mean, Ebert was one of my heroes growing up. Gene Siskel, there were all these parallels between our lives. And, you know, I got the call, and, like, you know, I felt like I'd played some A-ball, and then the Yankees were calling me up for the World Series. I'm like, I can do this, coach. I can do this. So what I learned is that Disney was horrified by my, like, bizarre, erratic hand gestures and mannered, creepy way of talking. So I didn't get the gig. And, like, the sixth episode, I came into Keith's office, and he said, hey, do you know who the next guest critic on Ebert and Roper is going to be? And I said, it's Zoran Kitt, isn't it? And he's like, yeah. So, and then at the end of my book, I was tempted to just write, I am Frank Grimes. That's actually what I said to myself. Like, I was pounding my head against the desk immediately after learning Zoran was going to be doing Ebert and Roper. But what I was able to see with a little hindsight was that I was incredibly lucky as well. And I have this amazing life, and, you know, I have great friends, a job I love. I'm putting out this book. People are really responding well to it. So I wrote, in the grand scheme of things, I'm 60% Frank Grimes, 30% Homer Simpson lucky bastard, and 10% moderately likable gay everyman, which is what the focus group for Movie Club said of me.
Raben comes across as an outsider throughout most of the Big Rewind. Does he still feel like an outsider now that he's a member of the Onion's AV Club?
I think that's one of the things that we at the Onion had in common, that we were all outsiders, and we were all a bunch of people with a lot of rage and a lot of disgruntlement and, you know, all this frustration. And that I found a community of outsiders in the Onion and in the AV Club. I mean, I think it's very telling that we kind of named ourselves after sort of the geekiest, outcasty segment of any high school. And I feel like I've played a big role in kind of determining the tone and the nature of the AV Club. So it's like I kind of built my own playhouse where, yeah, readers and commenters and pop culture enthusiasts can frolic and do so. So I think I've found a home there. And I think that makes me feel a little less like an outsider. But I feel like we've also kind of retained an outsider sensibility, and that we sort of see the world of pop culture not as, like, these, you know, schmoozing, like, insiders, like, we got the inside scoop, you know, but as, again, these kind of Midwestern, wry, you know, skeptical, a little bit cynical, a whole lot idealistic, I guess, evangelists for kind of the art that we love.
Nathan Raben is the author of The Big Rewind, a memoir brought to you by popular culture. He spoke with, to the best of our knowledge, producer Doug Gordon.